Okay, because I don't think so. I looked that up because I happen to be the proud owner for all of $5 of a Varian tunable magnetron that tunes 10 gigs. I'm not sure that it does, but it certainly looks like it by the waveguides that's coming out of it. So when you said pulses allowed on 10 gig, I was thinking maybe they changed the rules from when I looked it up. That would be fantastic. This tube weighs about 5 pounds. It's huge. It was brand new. I was hoping. Go ahead, Dick.
Yeah, pulse would be a lot of fun, Lou. It's got certain advantages and certain disadvantages. You don't have to be anywhere near as accurate in frequency. That's the good news. And depending on how you do the pulse rep rate and integration of the receiver, you can get some pretty nice thresholds out of it. You can do pulse code modulation, where you can be transmitting signals that only you and your buddy could demodulate. To everyone else, it'll sound just like noise. It'll sound like noise. So, pulsing, I've done a small amount of pulsing on a frequency close to 10 gigs. And by the way, you can tell what frequency that thing is made for by the size of the waveguide. The middle of the 10 gig band is WR90 waveguide. That really means that the major dimension of the waveguide, inner dimension, is 9/10 of an inch horizontal and about 0.45 inch vertical. That would be a waveguide that the waveguide itself is good for 8.4 to 12.4 gigahertz. The next size waveguide down is WR75, which is a little bit higher in frequency. And then I think there's a WR60. I can't remember the next one above in frequency, but WR75 is the one that's often used for KU band, around 15, 16 gigs. And then KA band, I guess, is the next one above that. So the size of the waveguide really tells you the frequency region. If you just look up Google the word waveguide sizes, or just Google waveguide plus K2RIW, or waveguide with WA1MBA, Whiskey Alpha 1 Mike Bravo Alpha, to find a nice article that's on the web that we issued a couple of years ago, Dr. Tom Williams and I, giving you the sizes of all of the waveguides. Let me drop. The sizes of all of the popular waveguides, both British and American, what frequency range they're good for, what maximum power they're good for, and so on. And there are waveguide sizes that go all the way up to 240 gigahertz. If you decided to use round waveguides at 240 gigahertz, the brass tubing you buy in a hobby shop, which has an inside diameter of 1/32 of an inch, is waveguide at 240 gigahertz. Very strange looking waveguide, but in fact, when you build a piece of equipment and you want to make sure that because you're using harmonic mixing to do a crystal control mixer that mixes your frequencies down to 1296, 432, 2 meters, whatever you use as a tunable IF, to make sure you're listening to the right frequency and not the wrong frequency, a smart guy will choose just the right size of tubing or rectangular waveguide that only that frequency or the next higher frequency can possibly go down it. The nice thing about waveguide is it's the world's absolutely sharpest high-pass filter you have ever seen. You take, for instance, WR90 waveguide, the stuff I'm talking about, 9/10 of an inch wide. I think its lower cutoff frequency is something like 6.5 gigs. You can look it up on that chart that I just told you about and find out the exact cutoff frequency. Let's assume it was 6.5 gigs. At 6.5 gigs, the signal goes down there pretty nicely. Go to 6.4 gigs, and the signal will have 100 dB of loss per foot of waveguide. Is that a sharp high-pass filter with a real fast, sharp cutoff on the low end? Waveguides like that. And if you're real smart, you can use that for making filters and whatever, and you make sure that you don't have any reentrance frequencies on the low end. So it's got some real fancy magic once you get past the fact that, there ain't no center conductor. How the heck can the signal go down there? And the answer is the signal bounces off the walls by the exact same technique. When you enter your barber shop and you've got mirrors on both walls and you look at the mirrors at a 45-degree angle and you see the barber three times in a row, the barber that's way downrange on the fourth chair, that's exactly what waveguide does. As far as the radio wave is concerned, those walls of the waveguide are a mirror, and the signal just zigzags down there. It doesn't need a semiconductor. That signal thinks it's in free space.
But repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
W2JPW, you got it, Lou. K2LIW.
Yeah, okay, Dick. Very interesting. Well, this magnetron is a baryon. It must be good for half a megawatt of peak power. It's the waveguide is 0.49 on the small dimension and the small dimension, yeah, and about a little under 1.1 on the large dimension. Well, that would cover 10 gigs. Go ahead.
Absolutely. That's called WR110 waveguide. That particular waveguide is the lowest loss waveguide you can use on 10 gigs that doesn't multi-mode. You can use always larger waveguides, but now the signal can go down there by more than one different kind of bounce, so to speak, and they call those modes. So WR110, beautiful waveguide. I mean, I'm guessing that tunable magnetron of yours probably goes down to around 7 gigs and probably up to around 10.0, and maybe you can stretch it to 10.5. But with that big a piece of waveguide, it's using the next band down, upper C band, lower X band, so to speak. And that's what WR110 is a slightly less popular guide, but for the guys who can get a hold of it, that is the lowest possible loss waveguide you could use at 10 gigs. The next size larger guide has more than one mode, and you can't guarantee that only the bounce you desire is happening. It could be bouncing down there by two different angles of bounce, so to speak. And so you have to be a little bit careful with that. And just because the waveguide, you're using it out of the normal frequency range, don't let that stop you. There are guys who, you know, are afraid to go a little bit beyond the ratings of the charts for fear that it's going to explode and catch on fire or whatever. No way. You can get away with murder. By the same token, when you look at your coax cables are not guaranteed in performance above a certain frequency. Well, lots of guys have used it at twice that frequency. And although it behaves a little bit, it misbehaves a little bit, you can still get some very good performance out of things that are used beyond. The hams, they don't let the usual rules stop them, Lou. Now back to you, Lou.
Yeah, well, that's I would really like to know about this 10 gig. Oh, I could just see myself doing this, though. This is a real monster. It must take at least 16 kilovolts of peak voltage on the pulse. Even that, maybe even more. The insulator on the bottom of it is about the ceramic insulator with a coax input for the high voltage and the filament. And the insulator is about almost an inch and a half long. So they've got some tremendous voltage on this thing. And then, let's see, the tube number is it's a VMX what? VMX 1198, I think that's the type of tube it is. Uh-oh, I just magnetized myself here. Go ahead, Dick.
Yo, that sounds like a real nice tube. Where did you run into that tube, Lou? At a flea market?
Yes, the guy had it on a table at the end of the day. How much you want for this? Give me $5. Go ahead.
Oh, boy, price is right. You got one hell of a magnet, and you got a real fun-type device. And I think you're saying it's got a tuning control on one side where you can change one of the dimensions of objects inside. It's probably got a bellows mechanism. And on the star wheel inside that does the resonating, most likely you can move some of those fingers to move the frequency. Sounds like a fun thing. If you get a hold of the ARRL Microwave Experimenter's Handbook, it's a $20 book. It'll give you a lot of information about similar things. Not exactly that tube, though. You'll have to go to a catalog for Raytheon products in order to find the exact specs on that tube. And if you signed into the Microwave Reflector, the WA1 MBA Reflector, Whiskey Alpha 1 Mike Bravo Alpha, and he's got a listserv where these guys send 15 messages back and forth to each other every day. There's about 1,000 guys scattered around all the major countries in the world that keep in contact with each other by way of this listserv on the website of WA1MBA. You go to WA1MBA.net or .org, I'm not sure what it is. You'll find out more information about this, Jazz. And so you put out the word on that listserv that I own a Varian VMX-119A tube. Does anybody have the data on it? And I give you an 80% chance somebody will come back and say, yeah, it's in my catalog, and these are the specs on the thing. It goes from this frequency to that frequency, and it puts out that many megawatts during the pulse. And it can take pulses of this duty factor and this rep rate and so on. It'd be fun to know what you've got. Sounds like the price is right, Lou. Good luck with that thing. And if you don't find a use for it, someday I'm going to go over there to Allendale, New Jersey, and hand you a fistful of dollars and say, you got to give me that thing. Over to you, Lou.
Okay, Dick. Well, the problem is, it probably is not usable on 10 gig because we're not allowed to do it. Check it out. I checked it out, and I think the next higher frequency, 24 gig is, or whatever it is the first frequency you use pulse on, but I may be wrong. So that's why I never, gave this much thought. I have a magnetron collection here. I have about four or five of them. Most of them are World War II vintage. I have another 10 gig with a big standing magnet from World War II. But that thing, I've used the magnet for so many things, it's probably not any good anymore. Although I keep keepers on it. So it's all, I've always been fascinated by them, but I never hooked one up. I had a friend, though, who was long gone, who hooked some up in his basement, and he fried himself with them. I've forgotten his call letters, but at least that's what I was told. And he went to the doctor, and the doctor said, what did you do that for? Back to you, Dick. W2JPW.
There's a fair number of cases, Lou, of where people thought they had created a radio frequency biohazard, and 90-some-odd percent of the time, what they thought was dangerous really wasn't when it got down to the nitty-gritty. A much higher danger that we ham radio operators run into is touching the high voltage because it wasn't properly shielded, protected, and grounded. So the high voltage is a lot more dangerous than the RF energy itself. Now, you get a high-power microwave traveling wave tool that can put out 200 watts into a piece of WR90 waveguide, and you turn that thing on and look down the barrel of that particular gun and put your eye at the end of it and stay there for 6 minutes. You're doing something extremely foolish, and yes, there's a moderately good chance you're going to cook your eye and develop a cataract in that particular eye. But as you can see, it took a whole comedy of errors to get yourself in trouble. High power, waveguide, long time, looking down the barrel while it's turned on. Nobody's right mind would do all of that. You stand in front of the dish, which has got a whole lot of gain, and you think you're a lot more dangerous. Uh-uh. The dish is spreading the energy out of a lot larger area, and therefore the watts per square meter is going down, and it becomes safe. The higher the gain of the dish, the safer it is when you stand in front of it. Opposite of common sense. But waveguide is a real concentrator. And we've all put our finger across the end of a coax cable when it's got some RF on it, and you feel the heat on your thumb, so to speak, when you touch the center conductor while the RF is turned on. Okay, I think we've gone through all the questions of the people who signed in tonight. Maybe a little bit earlier than normal. I think, Lou, we should go to your mailbag. And did we create more? Let's see. Did I just hear somebody who wants to check in?
KC2QIQ with a quick comment, Dick.
Yeah, and a follow-up on my question, Dick, if you have time, until we...
Glenn and Rich in that order. Go ahead, Glenn.
Well, while I was listening, Dick, I put a list together of 26 items of ham radio. It didn't take very long to do. Would you like me to read off the list real quick?
Let's hear the QIQ list.
Okay, AM, FM, single sideband, FSK, PSK, CW, RTTY, digital, which includes the packet, Pactor, Clover, but all is one, IRLP, Echolink, Longwave, HF, VHF, Microwave, Moonbounce, Satellite, APRS, Emergency Communications, Contesting, DXing, Rag Chewing, Repeater Operation, ATV, SSTV, Transmitter Hunting, and Pulse. What else did I miss, Dick? I think there's got to be a lot more than 26.
Infrared. Yep, you left out the infrared. You left out the Meteor Scatter, Moonbounce, Satellite, Aurora, Forward Propagated Tropospheric Scatter, Sporadic E. As you can see, your list has a whole bunch of things that my list didn't have. My list has a couple of things your list doesn't have. I know we're being conservative when we say there's 26. I bet you could easily, with various combinations, come up with 40 different kinds of ham radio-like two-way communication. And it doesn't have to be two-way communication. Ham radio operators, for just testing their equipment, get into radio astronomy and radiometry and all kinds of things. There's lots and lots of ways you can combine a human being, a microphone, a Morse code key, a computer, radio equipment, transmission lines of various kinds, antennas of various polarizations and angles, and beamwidths and gains. Your list didn't even get into the various kinds of propagating, whether it be horizontal, vertical, or circular, whether it be terrestrial or extraterrestrial. Yes, you did when you mentioned satellite. You didn't mention reflection off of aircraft and the International Space Station, or building bounce, or bouncing off of rain clouds, precipitation propagation, which is done on the 10 gig band and above, super refraction phenomenon. I think we already mentioned aurora. So there's lots of them. Each person who knows at least some of them will come up with a slightly different list, and you combine all those lists. 26 is a low number. I'll bet you it's closer to 40. Back to you, Glenn.
Yeah, I'm just putting the last group together: infrared, meteor scatter, aurora, horizontal mode, vertical mode. That brings you 30, 31, precipitation, 32, refraction, 33 different types. Just in a couple of minutes here, Dick. I think it's probably a lot more than 50 at KC2QIQ. Let's give it back to Rich.
Give that man a cigar. You got it, Mr. Cashner.
And God forbid the FCC takes away amateur radio frequency.
Okay, Dick, you also have antique radio list. That's one that nobody mentioned. All right. Dick, I don't know if you have anything on the computer there that's like a master catalog. If it's going to take a lot of time, don't worry about it. But I pulled off two of those knobs, and they both have the same nomenclature on them. S is in Sam, dash 402. I wanted to see if it was a date code, so I pulled off two different ones. S402, any ideas?
Okay, TJ.
Go ahead, Eric.
No, you finish with that, and come back to me.
Okay. Boy, did I get a great big document from Mr. Big Manny. Can't even think of the pronunciation of his name right now. Because he's got a brand new instruction guide, which must have been a presentation he made somewhere in a class. Wow. Trying to explain advanced television techniques. Nope, I can't. I don't have the whole catalog. Each time my computer starts downloading the catalog, it gets three-quarters of the way through and crashes over and over again. So all I can do is plug in the number, the 1510 you told me, and of the two responses I get, one of them shows me that knob directly, and you, me, and Glenn have been discussing that, and the second response shows me the total catalog, and my machine crashes every time it tries loading that total catalog. If you want, I can look at the other knob, but I don't know if I'm going to be able to help you a great deal, Rich. I'm not that much of a knob man. Back to you, Rich.
Okay, Dick. No, I meant I thought maybe you had like a master catalog that, other than that website. No, I wouldn't want you to load that again. I thought maybe the number S is in Sam 402 might mean something. All right, we'll just forget about it, and we'll keep looking. K2RIW, TechNet Limark, N2EO.
Yeah, I just had a search for Sierra 402, and on the Davies molding, it says there is no intercept on that one. So maybe it's sold by Alloyd or whatever, but it's not a Davies product. So Mr. Svignani Spagmoli, can't even think of the guy's call letters. I've got a document from him, and also somebody is shipping me a bound version, not just a Xerox version, of the thing that you and I have been passing back and forth. Eric, apparently there's a lot more coming out of that particular man if we search far enough. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
WHCD Alpha, quick call.
Go ahead, Andy.
I just need to speak to Eric a second. Eric, you still there?
I haven't gone anywhere, Andy.
Can I call you on the phone? I need to speak to you.
All right. Let me finish with Dick and then call me.
I just left you a message. You're like, call me back. Just call me on the phone. Thank you. Dick, back to you. Thank you. WHCDO.
You got Eric. You can call him Gary. It's much easier. Sprignoli. It's a funny pronunciation, but yeah. Anyway, the thing that I wanted to mention to you is that this past week, they had to do some work on the DTV antennas on Empire, and it just so happens that the 6-inch, actually 2 pieces of 3 and 3.5-inch coax was going through the wall, and the waterproofing people were coming around, and they had actually previously cemented it right into the wall. They had a chiseled away, so what they basically did was they cut that section of line, replaced it, made the whole thing and replaced it. But that did give us the opportunity to look at it coming from a single antenna without the other antenna. The way the CBS guys have it labeled is it's the TUA and the TUF. It's the and a TUB. It's the actual dielectric nomenclature. But it was interesting because, remember we were talking about intersymbol distortion. I'm going to drop. Well, looking at the RF, actually looking at it on a spectrum analyzer, it's about, when it's operating normally, it seems to be about 3 dB lower than it used to be before they changed the antenna. And I suspect that's because splitting it to go into the main antenna and the antenna that looks at Brooklyn or the backscatter antenna. Now, remember looking at the equalizer. And I have a picture of the equalizer before they did all this wonderful stuff up there. And the taps that were playing were a little bit in length. They were about 2, 3, 4 microseconds out. Now, no matter where I take your receiver, and I have some similar problems here at home where I'm really close to it, the first couple of taps are really being loaded, and receivers really have a hard time with it. So, I really think there's some inter-symbol distortion going on, because when they went to the single antenna, all of those equalizer hits went away. Although they were operating at much lower power, whereas everybody else could operate at full power, but CBS was operating at half power to give them plenty of room. So that's an interesting thing. And, you know, you break it down, I mean, you know, basically we're talking 3-bit words coming off of each symbol. So, you know, there's 24 levels. It gets you 8 bits after the trellis. So, K2RIW, K2J.
Interesting stuff. When you're talking about going directly through that line that was going through the concrete wall and you had to cut it off, and therefore you're no longer using the combiner, and I guess life got a little bit simpler, but still you're talking about, you said 2, 3, and 4 microsecond taps, and that strikes me as an amazing number. In free space, 1 microsecond is 1,000 feet. 2, 3 microseconds is 2, 3,000 feet. Yeah, your dielectric constant's a little bit slower in the feed lines, although I think these are airlines, so they're going to have a velocity factor of damn close to 0.95, 0.96, I'll bet you. So where's all those microseconds of delay coming from when it comes to either the equalization required or the antenna tuning itself? I'm not quite sure which. They strike me as very big numbers there. Where am I going wrong here, Eric? Go ahead.
No, it's probably me. The way the taps are labeled is they're really not labeled in nanoseconds. They're kind of coarse, so. Yeah, you know, I say 2, 3 microseconds, probably like a microsecond, because there's no resolution in the display. Don't forget, the thing goes out to like 40 or 50 microseconds, no, 70 microseconds on the back side. And what was it, 30 or 40 microseconds on the front side. Remember, we get into that imaginary reflection as being the primary signal. So, let's put it this way. The amplitude that the first couple of taps of the equalizer just light up like a Christmas tree. And you saw it with your eyeballs, you know what I'm talking about.
On that beautiful display in your shop, yes, I sure did. And I'm having trouble understanding why the first taps were so many microseconds. I presume up is advance and down is delay, but I'm not sure. But still, the first few taps were great, big numbers up. And I was assuming the first couple of taps are the front end of the delay line, so to speak. So why should so much... Okay, wait a minute now. If everything was perfect, and you didn't have any equalization at all, wouldn't 100% of the reception be on the very first tap of the delay line? Back to you, Eric.
Well, if there was no multipath and no issues, none of those taps would light up. Well, don't forget, we're looking at those taps being turned on and to how much level or to how much they're being turned on. Don't forget, we're really talking about a fur filter. It's a fur filter, right? It's a fur filter that each iteration that is going, each one of those, N plus 1, is the next tap down the line. So, you know, we're thinking of it in terms of really sample rate. So, really what we've got is 10 megasignals going, so that's going to be the rate that is happening. It's about 32 megabits. Yeah, because the trellis doubles everything up. So, you know, we're talking 19.39, and that's the actual rate at which the RF is happening, or each one of those symbols is happening. So that each tap would be that distance, and you know, the way it's marked, it's not really calibrated in microseconds and nanoseconds. It's number of taps. So if we figure the first two or three taps, then if we figure out what the actual rate is, and you know, convert 36 megabits into microseconds, or into nanoseconds.
Yeah, I'm looking through Gary's document right now, and he talks about 8 VSB and 16 VSB, and the various frequencies. I haven't gotten to the right section right now, where he gives you all the digitals. And he shows you the way it would look on a spectrum analyzer when you use various resolution bandwidths. He talks about using a band stop filter as a method of measuring compliance of the adjacent channel power ratios. What else am I looking at here? Can't find the section I'm looking for where the frequencies are given. He must have about 100 pages to this thing. Beautiful color display. If you don't already have a copy of this thing called Engineering Education : Transmission 8 VSB Receiver Block. Oh, that's that particular page. But it's the whole document, I think it's called Engineering Education. Let me go back to the very beginning where I get the title. Digital TV Action Items for Broadcasters, Gary Scrignoli. And what's the name of this darn document? I assumed it would have a name. Broadcast Engineering Education. I guess that's what it's really called. I wonder if you've seen this particular document of about 100 pages as a website. If not, I'll ship you a copy of it. Eric, go ahead.
Where'd you get it?
A buddy of mine in Texas shipped it to me.
I called Gary up and asked him to send it to me. I could actually dig up the numbers to be precise. So let's not deal with it. Let's call it samples. That way we don't have to worry about the numbers. But, most people don't realize, really, what this is like, you can call it vector modulation, is really what it is. Although we have the VSB part of it, which essentially all the information's in the I axis. There's nothing in the Q axis. There's no useful information. They actually use a Q axis to suppress the pilot carrier, and you know, we use that to train. There's a training sequence stuffed into it, if I remember right, and that's what trains the receiver's adaptive equalizer. So, but I mean, you know, it's just corny talking about vector modulation. Although when we think about, you know, color video signal, actually everybody's used to doing vector modulation. That's how you get color. Except we use a single frequency for that.
The
double sideband suppressed carrier, chrominance subcarrier, which is a vector modulation. It's got an I and a Q to it, yeah. The 8 VSB, he says, if you want to be exact, is 19.39265846 megabits per second.
Wow!
That's moving. Wow. Okay. If I mailed you a copy of this, and I think it's the hold on document is only a couple of megabytes, it's nicely compressed. If I sent it to your QRZ.com web address, would that get to you, Eric? Go ahead.
I don't have a QRZ.com web address. You know, you can send it to me at work. That's a good. Oh, you have it as a file?
I've got it as a beautiful PDF document, yes, ready to be shipped. Just give me an email address and I'll ship it to you.
Okay. It's spiegelly@13.org.
Okay, at 13.org, but I missed what comes in front of that.
Take my last name and put an E at the end of it.
Okay, your last name with an E at 13.org, and that goes directly to you as an email, is what I think you just said.
Yep, sir. That's it. Hey, you know, it's not actually, if you want to deal with the RF portion of it, it's not 1939, it's twice that.
38.7853 and so on, yes. By the way, 13.org. Is that 13 as a number or 13 spelled out? I'm going to guess it's 13 spelled out.
Oh, come on, you should know that. You've written enough emails. Yeah, 13 spelled out, not a number.
I'm forgetful and I haven't shipped anything there in a long time, so okay. Yeah, I'll mail it to you tonight, and beautiful document. You'll love it if you haven't already seen it. Also, as I said, Scrignoli, Gary's got a bound document that I think is on the way to me. So, now, if I understand correctly, that beautiful display that I saw at your place of business a couple of weeks ago, exactly 3 weeks ago on Thursday, because I know what I was doing that day. No, it was a Monday. I knew what I was doing 4 weeks ago on Monday, this coming Monday. The display, horizontally I presume each one of those tap points represent nanoseconds or microseconds of delay, and the vertical deflection represented the magnitude of that particular tap, up being positive and down being negative. Is that correct interpretation of what I was seeing with what looked like about 32 taps on that display? Go ahead.
That's correct, Dick. It goes out to, I think it goes out to like 70 or 80 microseconds, and the pre goes out to, that one, the earlier one, that's the third generation equalizer. I think that one only goes out to 30 microseconds in front.
Now, I know that the equalizers these days, the higher generation equalizers, can tolerate both lead and lag of, I guess I'm going to make a guess, 40 microseconds of lead and 70 microseconds of lag. Where on that display would the lead be displayed? That's the most left-hand tap point on that display?
Now, if you remember, that display is divided into a left side and a right side. The left side is the pre, the right side is the post. And the post was a lot longer than the pre.
And how could I tell left side versus right side? Was there a red vertical line telling me left side versus right side?
No, there were two windows. There were two bounding boxes around it. If you remember, it looks like a timeline, except there was one bounding box, a small one on the left, and a larger one on the right. And you could zoom in and move the marker around, remember?
I was so overwhelmed when I saw the display, I didn't catch all those nuances, so I'm going to have to see it again. Beautiful display. So, as they made these changes at Empire, did your display change accordingly?
Yeah, it did. Actually, I'm going to write an email to the guy that is in charge of it and see what he has to think about it, because I, for the life of me, can't imagine that they bundled up a 6-inch coax to make it so it's the same length to both antennas. I just can't see them doing that practically. I mean, maybe somebody thought about it and put a delay line in there.
So, at one time, I guess it was last week or the week before, you and I were making a discussion that we thought some of the grief of what you were seeing out in Plainview was due to you were getting signals simultaneously from the main antenna as well as the fill-in antennas, and therefore the interferometry between the two is potentially, when combined with multipath, giving you inter-symbol distortion that maybe was getting to the threshold where the equalizer was having trouble pulling the wheat out of the chaff. Is that approximately what was going on?
Yeah, well, I have an older receiver and a more modern receiver. The more modern receiver has less of a problem dealing with it than the older receiver does. And the interesting thing is the beam headings. It's another interesting aspect of it. The beam headings of where the antenna is pointed is slightly different. The replacement main antenna is exactly in the same physical spot on the Empire State Building on the tower. So it kind of makes you scratch your head. And used to be, you could use that one heading of your log periodic and get all the stations without a problem. Now it seems, depending upon what frequency they are, you have to move it a little bit. I can't figure that one, but if I'm going to look at the values of impedance and reactance of the various different antennas and the other antenna, I'm sure there's something going on there.
Okay, I've got to guess what might be happening here, Eric. Each of your individual frequencies you put into that master antenna and or the fill antennas give you some kind of a composite pattern. That pattern has got some bumps and grinds as a function of azimuth and elevation. Now, you take your log periodic plane view, as you go from channel A to channel B, when you aim that log in various directions, you are emphasizing more of the multipath that's bouncing off that water tower to the right of the great circle path versus the building that's bouncing off the signal bouncing off to the left of the great circle path. As you aim your log periodic, you are changing the individual coefficients of the magnitudes of the multipath signals that you're getting into your antenna. And that therefore stands to reason that the environment is being lit up slightly differently as a function of what channel you're talking about, and the ideal aiming of your antenna that gives the least amount of grief to your equalizer also has to change as you change channels. Does that seem to make any sense, K2LIW?
Oh, I understand your point of view, K2J. But remember, before this project began, you could get from 755 megahertz all the way down to 521 or 512, something like that, and not have to move it, and everything was happy, even on an older equalizer, which can do a little less multipathing. I mean, I go up my tower, and I can see the tower on the Empire State Building, so there's definitely nothing in the way, but there's other stuff to the left and right at various different points between where I am and where the Empire State Building is. So it's only after they've changed everything that we now have this property that didn't exist before.
Is the major difference between then and now the deployment of the fill-in antennas to get under the umbrella for the nearby listeners? Go ahead.
All right, the then is a single dielectric slot antenna that was really designed to be broadband, although the only thing that was expected to be pumped into it was channel 56, right? Now, with the coming of the analog going away, there's going to be a reshuffling of channel. And what's going to happen is channel 2, which is currently operating on 56, will move to channel 30. Channel 13, which happens to be operating at channel 61 on their digital, will move to channel 13, which means they're basically going off that system, and they'll be off that antenna and combine it. By the way, they've already modified the other transmitter to do the DTV, and that's working well. Let's see. A few other people move. There's a lot of frequency moving, and there's nothing now above channel 52 anywhere in the entire country. So that all goes to public service, everything above there. So let me let it drop. Now, since they've changed the
the antenna to be more efficient, as they say. That's an interesting thing now that I just thought about it. Could it be that the antenna is now designed to cut off at, say, channel 52 and they're pumping 56 in it? I kind of doubt that. I suspect that it's pretty much the same model of the antenna as it was there previously. But the big difference is now there's actually two additional antennas on the Empire State Building. One is what they call a backfill antenna, which lights up Brooklyn and Staten Island. And the other is a standby antenna, which is not being used when we're talking about this. So now we've gone to a situation where we're operating from two antennas, and we have all these issues. K2RW, K2J.
Yeah, I think channel 52 is 698 to 704. I think you said 52 is the highest channel that's going to be used. So everything above that is going to be given to other services. And I guess 56 and 61, 61 is going to go to 13, 56 is going to go to 30. So those higher channels are going to be used. You think the antenna is being modified to get ready for the channel 52 maximum. And maybe once all analog goes away and all the shoveling goes away, I guess life will become a little bit simpler when it comes to the multipath and inter-symbol distortion. Is that a possible guess?
No. I don't think as far as multipath goes and inter-symbol distortion, it's going to go away with what's up there. But what will happen is they will go for maximization. And I'll give you an example of what maximization would be. My ELP before maximization would be 95 kilowatts. After maximization, I'm up at 175 kilowatts, or 180 kilowatts, ERP. I'll give you channel 13. Channel 13, before maximization, would be 2.3 kilowatts, 2.3 kilowatts on channel 13, and after maximization, they go up to 9.6 kilowatts. So that's going to be where the major changes are. What they've got up there now, I think, no matter what, you're kind of stuck with it. It says they go to a higher power, I think it may help, but when it comes to multipath, you got more power, you usually got more reflections, too.
More power, more reflections. I'd like to believe the percentage of reflection in decibels down is going to stay about the same. But at the higher power, you're saying you're going to see more of them. They'll be above thresholds. And I presume the equalizer is even able to take out the reflections that occur within the antenna. Is that true?
All right, well, that's a whole other conversation, because most of the transmitters that I've ever seen, I think all of them actually, there is a device inside the exciter, which in essence, what you're really supposed to do is take a sample as close as you can to the antenna. You feed it back into, I mean, you can call it an adaptive equalizer. Each manufacturer has their trade name for it. In terms of the talent stuff, it's called a CADC, a CDAC. And what it really is a device which kind of measures the group delay and minimizes it. You know, it puts the appropriate, what it really does is it fiddles with the lookup tables that make the HVSD in the first place. Because don't forget, this modulation is not done in the traditional sense. It's done totally mathematically in DSPs that run on the carrier frequency. Think about that. I mean, think about doing multiplies and accumulate at cycle times somewhat faster than the actual RF frequency. There are a lot of exciters that will do it at, say, 70 megahertz and then multiply it up. But there are a few of them out there that actually do it at the carrier frequency, which is kind of wild. K2RW, K2J.
Okay, let me restate what I think I just heard. If you have a smart enough exciter-transmitter combination, and if you have a tap point within the antenna that's close enough to the point of radiation, the phase center of radiation.
Left you.
Say again?
And one thing I left out, because I went off in a different direction, is that nobody actually puts the sample up by the antenna, which is kind of a bad thing. Usually, the sample for all of these transmitters, right where the transmitter's coax leaves, where it goes into the combiner. Now, you know, the combiner itself can look like, you know, a 50 ohm load, and what's happening on the other side of the combiner might be invisible to the transmitter. So each input of the combiner is a, you know, a 50 ohm load cavity tuned to that particular transmitter's band test, because we're not talking about a single frequency, we're talking about 6 megahertz here. But now continue.
Okay, let me jump to the best of all possible worlds. If this is the best of all possible worlds, I would have a sampling antenna 1,000 feet out in front of the real broadcast antenna, right in the elevation of peak of beam. And that sample point, 1,000 feet in front, would show me exactly what's being radiated by the system. If I feed that back with a smart enough system, and that system can pre-distort what it is sending to the final stage of the transmitter, it can correct for a hell of a lot of grief that exists within the combiner, duplexer, diplexer, antenna, phased array, the whole thing. In theory, you can pre-distort to correct for everything so that what is being sampled 1,000 feet out is perfect. Am I being naive here?
No, that's absolutely correct. That is the selling point for a lot of transmitter manufacturers. That is the absolutely precise way to really look at the entire transmission system as a system and make the pre-distortions that are required. And it's different, by the way, between one that uses an MSDC, which is a tube, and, say, the one that you were looking at, which is 12 boards of power amplifiers being combined together to make the final signal. So the methodologies and the distortions that you would need would be somewhat different, but the end result would be the same.
Okay, if enough of the transmitters that will eventually be used at Empire have enough pre-distortion capability and enough smarts in the feedback mechanism by which true sampling of radiated signal takes place, that's a mouthful. I mean, not many of us are going to have a sampling antenna 1,000 feet out in front of an Empire transmitter. That's no man's land. I have to put up another building to do that. And hanging a helicopter out of there is out of the question. Just the rotary blades would kill you, even if you could hold the position right long enough time to make the measurement. So the thing that I'm worried about is that if I do the sampling anywhere other than that 1,000 feet out in front of the radiated pattern, if I do it anywhere along the transmission line of this multi-element phased array, which has bouncing signals going on within the radiating elements themselves, any attempt to do sampling there is going to get me an accuracy to the nearest, I'm going to pick a number, 30 nanoseconds, but if I want to get down to the nearest nanosecond, I don't think I can get there from here. Over to you, Eric.
All right. I mean, there's practical limits to reality, too, but I mean, consider this. What we're doing is manipulating a lookup table, right, in terms of how we create pre-distortion. That's the first thing. The second thing is, remind me, by the way, the next time I see you, to show you the proposal for when the World Trade Center went down, that they were going to anchor a balloon up there and put all the broadcast transmitters on this balloon along with the antennas. They were actually going to do it. This was an amazing proposal. They actually build these balloons as transmission platforms for a number of things. But anyway, the best place that you can possibly, in practical reality, take a tap would be at the base of the antenna. That would be the best place in the world to take a sample, because you've got a pretty good picture of everything up to that point. Okay? So if you're doing good there, chances are you won't be doing too much worse coming out of the antenna. That's the first thing. Secondly, if we want to put real numbers to this, all right, as far as the standard is concerned, signal noise, or error vector magnitude error,
okay, signal noise has to be 27 dB or higher. How you come up with this number, by the way, is another interesting formula, and if you open your book there, you'll see it. But anything greater than that does not actually buy you anything, okay? I mean, I can get the signal noise on my transmitter, say, up to maybe 34, 35, 36 dB, with, say, the errors of the vector magnitude to be like 1.2%, 1.1%, something like that, which is actually quite good. But yet, maybe at the friend zones of being able to pick it up, you know, you can't really say that it's going to increase your friend zone by 5 miles or 10 miles or 15 miles. But, you know, that's a debate that everybody has. But, I mean, stands to reason, the better quality signal you start with, the better off you're going to be in the long run. K2RW, K2J. I can see that.
And the 27 dB is a little bit similar to the numbers that are required for 16 QAM or 64 QAM. When you're transmitting a more compressed signal with more bits per symbol, a higher carrier-to-noise ratio is required in order to have the right, what is it now called, constellation diagram test set landing accuracy, if you know what I mean, to land on the right points without ambiguity. Higher carrier-to-noise ratio is required because you're literally exceeding what Nyquist used to think was required for number of bits per second versus instantaneous or noise equivalent bandwidth of the system. So a higher carrier noise ratio is required so that you can resolve without ambiguity those minor IQ phase differences. Fun stuff. Looks like you've got one hell of a toy there, Eric. You've got one patent and you can sound and we'll be playing with these for years to come. Tweaking, improving, and so on. It's not only a matter of power, but accuracy, spectral purity, and so on. Fun stuff. We probably ought to move on. I'll be shipping you something later on tonight. Mel, I think it's time we open up the mailbag. Go ahead, Eric.
By the way, I know you don't have a satellite receiver going, but if you want to hear the space shuttle audio, you know, what's going on upstairs, you can tune to my repeater and it's playing. That's the first thing. The second thing is, do you use WR90 or are you a fan of flexible copper pipe for 10 gigs?
The answer is all of the above. When it comes to the button hook feed horn on the actual dish itself, that is a 3/4 inch water pipe with a 45 degree and 90 degree elbows. When it comes to the waveguide where I use it, it's WR90. Didn't have enough WR112. But the majority of my real transmission was a approximately 1 foot length of UT141. See, my transmitter was in a box behind the dish at the top of the tower. I fed power up there. I fed 2 meter signals up there, and it was a transverter. So the 2 meter signal got transverted to 432, a linear transverter. So sideband in became sideband out. Upper sideband in became upper sideband out. It had a lower LO. And so from the box that contained the transverter and transmitter to the dish was, as I said, about a 1 foot length of UT141. And that particular dish that I was using, that's not on the tower now, I got to restore it, then went over to WR75, a short length of it for that particular button hook. So once you go over to waveguide, and once you don't have a very long length of it, the insertion loss becomes academic. If I was feeding waveguide all the way up the tower, without a doubt, I would have used 3/4 inch water pipe because it has lower loss than mil-spec, silver-plated WR90 waveguide with dry nitrogen fill. And I'm not kidding. Round 3/4 inch water pipe at a Home Depot has considerably lower loss. That's the good news. The bad news, if you got a minor amount of runout, you may launch a horizontal signal at the bottom of the tower and it may arrive as vertical at the top with a little bit of elliptical polarization added in besides. So you got to do some careful tuning. Back to you, Eric.
Okay. Here's the reason why. I'm in the middle of putting together an amateur television repeater that's analog and digital. And I'm thinking, I don't really want to mount the stuff up on the tower. And also, there's this German antenna, a slot antenna, that's really to my liking. And he's got an end connector on it, but, you know, and a button inside. And I just want to feed it. So I'm thinking 3/4-inch copper pipe. Also, I'm going to be taking signals in that way, too, so I want to... There I could probably put the down converter up on top, but I really don't want to do that because I want to go up there once and never go up there again.
Okay, is this on 10 gigs is question number one, and number two, how many feet of transmission line is required?
I figure maybe about 150 feet.
Okay, at 150 feet, you're at that critical point. 150 feet of WR-75 would have about 7.5 dB of loss. That's quite a lot of sacrifice on both transmit and receive. And with preamplification, you can make it up on receive, and by putting the final tube of the transmitter up there, you can make it up on transmit. But 7.5 dB of loss is going to be a little bit hurting. That's for WR-75, and I think it would be like 6.5 dB or 6 dB of loss with the 3/4-inch water pipe. And the 3/4-inch water pipe is nice and inexpensive and a fun installation. Making a flexible waveguide out of that, though, we haven't solved that problem yet, haven't attacked that problem yet. Some of the corrugated copper pipes you can buy probably would serve for a flexible guide. But you're not going to be, oh yes, you are going to be doing some steering unless you've got probably an omnidirectional antenna. By the way, this ATV, is it going to be a transmitter or a repeater? I'm guessing it's a repeater, Eric, go ahead.
It's a repeater. You go in on UHF, you go in on 1.2 FM, you go in on 10. Hopefully you'll be able to go in on 3 and change and 5 if I get it together. The upper ones will be FM. The 10 might be a digital. The 70 centimeter might be a digital. Different kinds of digital, too. The kind of digital where you can build a little box and hook it up to your PC and use the PC as the display device, rather than try and write software for all this stuff, which would take me the rest of my life. I use stuff that's already written and just do my own modulation scheme.
Okay, you've got the facility to do what Kerry Banky has done in San Diego, California. He's been doing it for a couple of years. Very successful operation. 10 gigahertz F1 repeater. He's got an omnidirectional receiving antenna at one altitude on the tower. That goes into something like 100 decibels of gain, which transmits out of a second omnidirectional antenna 20 feet higher on the tower. Except for a rain cloud coming by where he gets a reflection over it, and it gets into a little bit of an oscillation, which is not bad. It still repeats beautifully while it's oscillating. Because you look at it with a spectrum analyzer, the oscillation is smeared over 30 megacycles, and the one transmitter that you're putting into it comes out to, with just a little bit less gain because of the oscillation creating a little bit of limiting. But that F1 repeater is a fun toy. He's got a whole lot of guys down in the valley aim their signal up at this F1 repeater that's on a broadcast tower on top of a hill near Palomar, as I remember. And out comes a signal 100 dB stronger, and everybody hears it, even though it's in being emitted from a simple dish on the top of a garage down in the valley. I wonder if you've heard about that operation, and when you want to hear some more words about it, I've sent him quite a few emails. A real fun operation. Back to you, Eric.
No, I've heard something, but not specifically of this guy. Is he using a linear translator between the two, or is he just have the waveguide and one antenna connected to the other?
The receiving antenna, 20 feet lower on the tower, with no frequency translation, goes into a linear amplifier of something like 100 decibels of gain, and out of the upper transmitter antenna comes that exact same signal. By way of his communication link to it, he can program in the number of decibels of attenuation somewhere in the middle of the amplifier chain so as to stop it from oscillating if he wants to. but there are times when he just let it oscillate, and it just squitters all over the place so fast that it doesn't create any interference for anybody. It's reflecting off of atmospheric inhomogeneities and rain clouds or whatever. There is no one fixed phase or frequency it breaks into an oscillation on. It smears its power